And our special guest, Douglas Preston, tonight, as we're talking about artificial intelligence. Wow, some incredible things here. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Douglas Preston with us. Incredible work here, Douglas, into this. And, you know, most of your books are, you know, based on really just thinking and, you know, different events and stuff. As you mentioned in Blasphemy, you started to kind of include the possibilities of things that could happen. What else could go wrong with artificial intelligence?
Well, there is the whole question of what they call algorithmic trading on Wall Street. You may have heard of that new novel called, a nonfiction book called Flash Boys by Michael Lewis. And that's about high-frequency trading. And it's, essentially, it's about a bunch of very smart traders who were managed to impose themselves between, you know, in the trading process and shave a few pennies off each trade and, make billions of dollars doing it and basically ripping off everyone else. But algorithmic trading is a kind of high-frequency trading that uses computers to trade shares without any kind of human intervention or action taking place. And the something like 70% of all stocks traded on the exchanges recently were traded by computers. But there's a certain type of algorithmic trading which is using artificial intelligence. And essentially, this type of trading has, is a program that is out there and it's monitoring the, you know, it's ready to trade and it's looking for certain unusual conditions to occur so that it can make the trade in a matter of milliseconds. But what they've got going now is are programs that actually read the news. They're hardwired into the news feeds. They read the news, they understand it, and they trade based on that news within a 1/10,000th of a second of receiving the news, much faster than a human being could possibly. I mean, you couldn't even open your Wall Street Journal in time for the for these programs.
And they're way ahead of the curve, aren't they? Way ahead.
They are, and the AI ability of these programs is increasing all the time. For example, now, just recently, they have developed programs that are that can judge the sentiment of a news report. So they could it can tell if the news is generally good or bad.
And what's going to happen.
And then trade on that news. Or there's AI software that's monitoring millions and billions of Google searches on stocks. And if they find a lot of Google searches on a stock all of a sudden, this program knows, you know, either sell that stock or buy that stock because it combines those Google searches with the type of news that it's getting. You know, for example, you know, General Motors is being investigated for, you know, ignition switch problems. You know, that news comes in, a computer program digests that news, and then shorts General Motors stock in less than a thousandth of a second.
And they make big bucks.
They make
when
billions,
that stock goes down.
Tens of billions of dollars. I was trying to get some indications of, what kind of profits they're making. And I mean, you know, 10 to 20 to $30 billion a month easily on this. It's very hard to get data on this.
And it's legal, isn't it?
It's totally legal. And all the big banks and firms are doing, you know, Goldman Sachs, you know, Credit Suisse. I have a list here of algo trading programs. These are programs that use AI in trading stocks. And if you, if I just read off some of the names of these programs, I think you'll get a sense of just how crazy they are. Now listen to this.
All right.
All right. The Circus Comes to Town.
That's the name of the program.
That's the name of the program. A Clogged Artery. Danger Will Robinson. I like that one.
That's my favorite. We know Billy Mumy, who was from Lost in Space.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yellow Snow. Scofflaw.
Seizure.
The Shredder, Heart Attack, Don't Tread on Me, You Don't Know Jack, and The Abyss. These are all actual programs which trade stocks and, you know, essentially are, for anyone who owns a pension fund or mutual fund shares or owns some stock that your grandmother gave you or whatever, we are being taken to the cleaners by these algo programs.
Can anybody buy those programs?
Well, no. They're proprietary, they're top secret, and the important thing about these programs are that they have to operate very, very close, in very close proximity to the exchange themselves, to the stock exchanges themselves, because the speed of light is a factor in this. If you're trading in Iowa, you even with a computer transmitting at the speed of light through fiber optic in order, you are going to get taken to the cleaners by a computer that's in New Jersey right next to that stock exchange, which the speed of light is a factor in this. So you have to actually own extremely big and powerful computers physically located right at the stock exchanges. And believe me, small-time investors don't get any access to computers like that.
Is the software, the AI, is it ever wrong?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's autonomous. It's making decisions based on what it thinks the news says. And yes, it can be wrong. And there's a great deal of fear out there that at some point some of these programs are going to make the wrong decision and crash the stock market. I mean, it's already happened, with the triple witching hour back in 87 and things like that. Those were kind of events caused.
That's 17-year-old technology, too, right?
Exactly. And then the flash crash, that occurred. But there was a recent trading loss, a company running an algo program. The program wasn't malfunctioned. That company lost $443 million in very short order. Now, that's just one company, and $443 million is not that much money when you consider the size of what happens on Wall Street every day, the amount of money changing hands.
Poor old Jim McMahon from the World Wrestling dropped $350 million a few days ago.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Things kind of plummeted a little bit. They didn't like his TV deal with, I think, NBC.
Oh, is that
and
right?
Then, whoosh, down it went.
Oh, it's you've got to have a cast iron cast iron stomach to be able to take that kind of thing. But there's a lot of fear that these algo programs would crash the market or cause a tremendous amount of damage. Some kind of runaway situation would occur, and in less than 2 or 3 seconds, the entire market might have crashed before even a human being could react to it.
Let's get back to Hal for a little bit and its decision to kill off those astronauts. When that movie came out, I mean, nobody even thought about the computer age. I mean, we really didn't.
No, it was incredibly prescient. And I remember I saw that movie as a kid, and I thought, isn't that cool? What a cool idea.
Yeah.
But, of course, that would never happen. But you also remember in that movie when the astronauts are talking to their kids at home, they're looking at a computer screen that looks an awful lot like Skype.
Yeah, it really does.
So a lot of things, that was an amazingly forward-looking movie. But Hal makes a very logical decision. He's looked at all he's like Deep Blue, he's a chess-playing mm-hmm. computer. He's looked at every single move, and he says, well, the best move is to get rid of these human beings, because that will maximize the probabilities of success for this mission, and he proceeds to kill them.
When he made that decision, and it was the best decision of his grouping, at that time, of course, everybody watched the movie. They were just outraged. They were in shock. But in reality, was that the best move?
Well, that's interesting. That's a very interesting question, because what would have happened if he hadn't killed all those astronauts? Would the mission have been the success that it was? And I mean, the movie is a little ambiguous about whether the mission was successful or not.
Yeah, we don't know that. Just saw the huge embryo at the end, right?
Exactly. So I mean, at least it was successful for that one astronaut, whatever he became.
What was his name? Dave?
In the movie?
Dave, yes.
Yeah,
now,
there's
something else about that movie that's very cool. When Alan Turing first hypothesized artificial intelligence, he proposed that the way to create it, I mean, a thinking machine, would be to start with a fairly simple childlike program and then subject it to a course of education that would turn it into a very sophisticated, simulated, you know, human mind. Just like a child is subjected to a course of education in order to create an adult human. And if you recall in that movie when he's deactivating Hal and pulling out all his memory sticks, the last thing that happens is that Hal starts singing a nursery rhyme that he learned when he was just a little baby, and just a little child.
You know, Douglas, as you look at all this right now, even beyond, of course, the weaponization and everything else, where else do you see artificial intelligence going?
Well, the thing is, we see it actually all around us. I mean, when we use Siri, when we use our, you know, map, you know, one of those navigational programs where the voice speaks to us, take a left, take a right. I mean, that is all forms of artificial intelligence. And a lot of artificial intelligence is very specifically oriented towards solving some task, like the Roomba. You know, the Roomba has a little bit of AI in it that prevents it from getting hung up, that causes it to change direction when it hits a wall and so forth. So we're going to see more and more AI all around us in everything we do, and a lot of it's going to be invisible. But the specific AI that runs Siri, that runs the Roomba or whatever, is very different from the generalized intelligence AI needed to, for example, operate a probe on the Kraken Sea of
right.
Titan.
But I bet there was more intelligence in that little Roomba than there was in the 1969 landing on the moon.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt about it. I mean, your smartphone has a computer that's, you know, millions of times more powerful than the mainframe computers that they were using at NASA at that time.
Amazing. I remember Buzz Aldrin was telling us that in order to get off the moon, the button wouldn't work. He had to use his Bic pen to stick it down into a little hole in order to get the button to work, and off they went. Or they would have been stuck on the moon.
That is really, really interesting. Now, in the old days, when before the days of personal computers, a Princeton University had a big mainframe computer. And this computer had a word processing program, and all the graduate students started writing their dissertations on this computer. Well, one day the computer crashed, and a student lost her entire 4 years of work.
Oh, my gosh.
And so the English, she was in the English department at Princeton. I mean, they didn't know anything about computers. So after that point, the English department passed a rule that said whenever you submitted material for your dissertation, you also had to submit the punch cards that had the memory, you know, that contained
mm-hmm.
the data
that they could grab.
That was printed out. And so the box of punch cards was a lot bigger than the actual manuscript of the dissertation.
Yeah.
So the memory storage was much larger than the memory storage on paper of typed out.
Those old UNIVAC computers, remember?
Yes.
Those punch cards and all that stuff. And I could never figure out, Douglas, what those cards did.
Well, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate, or man, you're going to be in jail. You remember on the toll roads, they used to give you these punch cards. And if you folded it or messed with them, when you turned them in at the toll booth,
you had to pay
through.
You had to pay the full rate or something.
Yeah, you had to pay a fine or the full rate. But, well, what they essentially did was they stored data with these little tiny square holes in them. And when they were run through a machine, the machine would basically read these holes, which were basically the zeros and ones of a computer program, you know, of storage, of information storage, and reconstruct whatever it was. But it was an incredibly...
And those were tubes in the UNIVAC, right? They didn't have chips then, did they?
No, they didn't. They had the old vacuum tubes and
That's
switches.
Right.
They had a bunch of switches. And Yeah, that was before the days of the miniaturization of, you know, printed circuits and so forth.
See, kids nowadays would never be able to live in that era. I mean, as we probably couldn't live in the 1800s, but what would you prefer? I mean, because you lived then, you live now. If you had a choice to go back or to stay in this era, what would you do?
Well, I feel sorry for kids today. I mean, when I was a kid, I'd come home from school, I would, you know, change my clothes, and then my parents would,
you'd go outside,
shoo us out of the house, and we'd be outside until dark.
Yep, playing baseball, whatever you did.
We ran around the neighborhood. No one worried about crime. No one worried about you know, all the things that the parents worry about today.
Being abducted, none of that.
Yeah, and there was none of this hovering helicopter parentage where you're being shuttled around to baseball games and football games and soccer games. I mean, we'd play wiffle ball with a stick, you know, in a vacant lot. And I love that. And I just feel sorry for kids who come home from school and the first thing they do is fire up their computer or their Game Boy or whatever.
They don't leave. They don't leave. They don't know what it's like to go outside and play.
Well, they're getting fat.
Yeah.
And now it may be.
But they're smarter than we were. I bet.
They may very well be smarter than we are, but they're not. What kind of fun are they going to have in life? That's what I worry about.
Wiffle ball, the greatest pitch with a wiffle ball was the knuckleball.
Oh, yeah.
Remember how it like kind of just floated in the wind and it would shimmy back and forth?
Great. It would because of the way it was spinning and those holes in the ball.
Yeah.
You could really get some action.
Oh, my gosh. Loved it. I used to do that all the time.
Yeah, and, you know, we used to walk to school. Our parents would send us out the door, and the rule at the school was, which was about three-quarters of a mile away, was that kindergartners had to be taken by an older sibling, but if you were in first grade, you could walk to school by yourself. I mean, nowadays, you go back to my town, I'm sure that the kids are all being driven to school.
Well, that's true. They probably are.
So I don't think I'd trade my childhood for anything in the world.
No, I wouldn't either. But you also remember as a kid, we used to play, you know, cowboys and Indians or, you know, and we'd have cap guns. And no kid then ever thought of shooting somebody for real. Ever. It never even entered our minds. Today, if you saw a little six-year-old kid with a pistol, a little cap gun, you'd freak out.
Yeah, you know, that's very true. I mean, if you brought a cap gun to school, which you know, kids did, you know, to fool around on the playground,
yeah.
You'd be, not only would you be sent home, but the cops would be there, and then you'd be bundled off to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, exactly. They'd say you have to have some kind of psychiatric evaluation, and that would be it for you.
Oh, we were bad kids, too. We used to ride through the neighborhood with firecrackers, tossing them off our bikes, you know, and raising hell, and you know, we all there was a neighbor who could always be counted on to call the police, which is of course what we were hoping, and then we could see the police coming a mile away, and then we had escape routes and everything else. We were never caught, but we had a lot of fun.
I used to run up and down the neighborhood dressed like Zorro.
Oh, that's great.
And that little plastic sword and everything else, and they were different times.
Yeah,
they really were.
Yeah, I just feel sorry for kids. They're just covered over.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because it has become a babysitter. It's easy for a parent to just throw the kid in the room and say, watch the video, and, you know, we'll be back later.
Well, you know, kids' lives are so controlled now by all this that no wonder when they grow up they accept so much more control from the government.
Yeah.
Not to get into a political discussion here, but, I mean, I wonder about NSA and spying and all this effort of the government to control, and people don't really seem that exercised about it when I think they should be. You know, I think 150 years ago, people would have been more exercised over the kind of government surveillance that we see today.
I think so. Douglas, I want to talk about some of your works that you've written, and we'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we flip the switch and we take your phone calls. Let's come back and talk a little bit more with Douglas Preston about some of his works right here on Coast to Coast AM. Douglas, let's talk about some of your current works, and tell me about The Monster of Florence and what's going on there.
Well, that was a case I became involved in when I was living in Florence, Italy. I learned that the olive grove outside, the beautiful olive grove outside of our villa that we rented, had been the scene of a horrific double homicide committed by a serial killer known as the Monster of Florence. And he'd never been caught, and the case was still open. And I'd come to Italy to write a murder mystery set in Italy, but I got fascinated with a monster case and instead teamed up with an Italian journalist who had covered the killings from the beginning, and we wrote a book about the Monster of Florence. It's a horrific case. The monster makes Jack the Ripper look like Mr. Rogers. It's one of the most awful stories of a serial killer that I've ever encountered.
16 murders, wasn't it?
That's right, 16 murders. Young people making love in cars parked in the beautiful hills surrounding the city of Florence.
Like the Zodiac killer, almost.
Exactly, and the monster would kill the man first, and then he would kill the woman, and then he would perform a ritualistic, I almost hesitate to go into it on the radio, and he was he did this over a period of 11 years, and was never he was a fantastically competent killer. He only left the clues he wanted to leave, and nothing more.
And he was never caught.
He was never caught. He was never identified. Although what would happen is the Italian police would arrest someone for being the monster, and then he would kill again as a way of mocking them, and they'd have to release the person they arrested, and then they'd arrest somebody else. But then the monster very strangely stopped killing in 1985, and the Italians arrested a number of people, and some of them were convicted, and then their convictions were overturned. But the case was essentially never solved. It's still open, and it's become the longest and most expensive criminal investigation in Italian history.
And these murders that occurred and then they stopped, do you think this person may have died? Could it have been several people or just one?
Well, it was all the evidence was it was just one person. All the evidence at the scenes of the murder, the reconstructions of the killings indicated only one person. But when the Italians were desperate to find this guy, they commissioned a secret report from the American FBI and from their famous, behavioral science unit. And they discovered, the FBI report said the monster could control what he was doing and would stop killing under certain circumstances. And the report laid out all the characteristics of the monster, who he was, what his level of education was, what kind of car he probably owned. It was amazing what they did. And the Italian police suppressed the report, saying that it, because it didn't agree with their crazy theories. Well, my writing partner, Mario Spezzi, this Italian journalist, looked at this report and he said, holy, holy moly, this is a perfect description of one of this man who was peripherally involved in the case. And Mario looked into it and became absolutely convinced that this individual was the monster of Florence.
Now, what happened to that individual?
Well, nothing.
He's still alive?
Still out there, and I was, Mario and I first were writing an article for the New Yorker magazine on this, and I was talking to my editor at the New Yorker, and she said, have you interviewed this guy yet? Have you asked him if he's the monster of Florence? And I said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. And she got mad. She said, wait a minute, what kind of journalist are you? We've got journalists in war zones being shot at, and you're afraid to interview a little serial killer? You know, give me a break, you know. So we went in there, and we went to his house at about 9:45 at night because we knew we'd only have one shot, and we rang the buzzer. He let us in. Mario lied about who he was. Mario was so afraid that he used a fake name, but the monster, the person we were interviewing, immediately recognized him and said, oh, I must have misheard your name. You're Mario Spezzi. You're the guy who wrote all those articles about the Monster of Florence. I've read everything you've written.
Oh, was he creepy?
You know, I was expecting someone very creepy and weird-looking and strange.
Yeah.
And instead, I was confronted with a very handsome, charismatic guy with a great deal of working-class charm who really reminded me of Robert De Niro, the young Robert, well, the middle-aged Robert De Niro, totally self-possessed, smiling all the time, invited us to sit down. He was dressed only in his underwear. His body was covered with hideous scars.
And what kind of scars?
They looked like knife scars, and some of them were puckers that looked like bullet holes. But we did research into this, and we couldn't find any evidence that he'd ever been shot.
Self-inflicted, maybe?
We don't know. But we started questioning him, and it became fairly obvious about halfway through the interview that we suspected him of being the monster.
You did? Okay.
And he kept smiling. He never lost his cool, and even a final question when Mario said, "So, are you the monster of Florence?" Now, his response is completely unrepeatable on the radio, but he never stopped smiling.
Did he lose his cool?
Never. And as we were leaving, he leaned over Mario in a very low voice. He said, "You know, Mario, I'm smiling. But don't get me wrong. I never play games. I don't joke around. Just remember that."
Like he was trying to tell him he was.
Yeah, well, he knew. This is the thing. This interview, this man knew more about the case than had ever been published in the newspapers.
Well, that tells you something right there.
And now the medical examiner's report said that these ritualistic mutilations were probably performed with a scuba knife. And that never came out in the newspapers.
A jagged scuba knife.
Yeah, you know the type. It's a thick
knife. But I've never been to Florence, by the way.
Well, you know, it's a very unusual knife, and people don't carry that knife around the streets of Italy.
It's a big knife.
But at a certain point, he told us, he said, yeah, I had a fight with my father, and I held my scuba knife to his throat. And he kept repeating that he had a scuba knife. It was almost like he was baiting us.
That's amazing. So he would be how old now?
He'd be in his early 60s.
Early 60s. And he stopped by what, 85?
He stopped in 85.
85.
That's right.
So he stops in 85. What compels him to stop? How does a serial killer who has this horrible urge just stop?
Well, that's an interesting question. The FBI report said that this type of serial killer actually was in control of his actions. He didn't have that absolute compulsion to kill. He killed because he liked it. It gave him pleasure. And it said he would stop killing if he met an older woman who became a kind of a surrogate mother figure to him. He would stop killing under those circumstances. Now, 2 months after the last killing in 1985, he met a much older woman, and he didn't marry her, but they've been living together ever since.
Was she there that night you went there?
She was, and it was very creepy.
This is amazing.
When we came into the apartment, this old woman is washing spinach in the sink, and the man we interviewed just ordered her out like a dog. I've never seen anything so incredibly offensive in my life.
And she just jumped right at it.
She did. She was like, you know, stooped and shut and sort of furtively scurried out, just like a beaten dog. It was really scary.
Maybe he replaced this wretched serial killer actions with whatever he did to her.
You know, it's the psychology of, see, this fellow had suffered horrific trauma as a child.
They all do, don't they?
Yeah, and it started with witnessing his father murder his mother. And then his father proceeded to have these really strange relationships with multiple people and orgies in the house and forced the 7-8-year-old boy to participate.
Destroyed the kid.
It absolutely destroyed him. And
now, we're saying that about the serial killer, or are we saying that about this guy?
About this man, this guy.
This guy went through that.
Okay. This guy went through that, but we suspected the serial killer.
Well, there's no way he could be normal going through that. There's no way.
I know. I mean, there's so many. And, you know, one of the things we did, Mario laid out a map of Florence and said, look, I've mapped where you lived over the time of the killings. And here are the killings, and here's where you were. How come you were always seem to be living within a very short distance of the murder when one of the murders when it took place?
Amazing.
And he just smiled and said, coincidence.
What kind of shoddy police work didn't get him arrested?
Well, it's called saving a face. The Italian investigation had gone way off the rails, and their theory was that this was not a lone serial killer. It was a satanic sect that dated back to the Middle Ages that needed these women for their body parts so they could celebrate black masses and use the woman's body parts
wow.
as the black, as the wafer.
They went into a totally different direction then, didn't they?
Yes, and they were very, when they became aware of our, that we were writing a book and also interviewing people and conducting an investigation like journalists do, the police became very upset. And I'll never forget, one day I was walking, this is how the Italian police arrest somebody, listen to this. I was walking through the streets of Florence and my cell phone rings, and this officious voice, speaking Italian, says, is this Mr. Preston? Yes. This is the police, where are you? We are coming to get you right now. And I said, well, first I thought it was a joke, and
yeah.
then I said, well, what if I don't want to tell you where I am? And the man said, Mr. Preston, if we have to find you, that will not be good. That will not be a good thing.
Jeez.
You tell us where you are. And they did, and they came and they got me, and they hauled me in for an interrogation, a 3-hour interrogation in Italian, no lawyer present, no interpreter. And, my Italian is not really that good, and when you're interrogated,
it's
foreign language. It's
yeah.
terrible. They accused me of being an accessory to murder, of planting evidence, and of obstruction of
Whoa.
Justice and all these crimes. And they said that Mario, my writing partner, was a member of the satanic sect that committed the monster's murders. And they had evidence that he murdered a doctor in near Lake Trasimeno in 1985.
Did he?
No.
Oh, okay.
The doctor whose death was by drowning by suicide. That's what the coroner said at the time. Well, they dug the doctor up and they did more tests on him and they confirmed that he died from drowning and that it was a suicide.
They actually thought you were part of this?
They did. They did.
How did you get out of it?
They said at the conclusion of the interview, this prosecutor, this very powerful, he's like a district attorney, said that he would lift he indicted me for these crimes, too. He didn't just accuse me. He actually took a book down off the shelf, read off the indictments, and then said, you're indicted now for these crimes. And then he said, we're going to lift the indictments temporarily so you can leave Italy.
What?
And so I left with my family the next day. We went straight to the airport, and we left.
And they never pursued arresting anybody else?
Well, they arrested Mario, my writing partner, and threw him in prison and accused him of being the monster of Florence. And there was such an international uproar, because he's a very well-known journalist, and this was so bogus, that he had to be released in 3 weeks. But they traumatized him in prison. Traumatized him.
What an incredible story.
And here's the best part of it, or the worst part. This prosecutor is the same prosecutor as in the Amanda Knox case.
Oh, my. Unbelievable.
And he did the same thing to her. He hauled her in for an interrogation, only her interrogation lasted 54 hours over a number of days.
Do you remember the movie Hannibal with Anthony Hopkins?
I certainly do, yes.
There was an inept Italian police officer who ultimately got killed by Hopkins.
That's right. It's interesting you should bring that up, because Thomas Harris, the author of that book, was fascinated with the Monster of Florence case, and he actually attended some of the trials of some of the people accused of being the monster, and he based Hannibal Lecter in part on the Monster of Florence.
And I didn't know that.
And that police officer that you're mentioning, in the movie, his name was in the book, his name was Rinaldo Pozzi, was basically based on the central prosecutor in the monster case, whose name was same initials, RP, I can't remember his real name. But, it was a very thinly disguised portrait of the monster. Hannibal Lecter is, was partly based on the Monster of Florence, at least who they think he was.
That was a great movie too, the way they did. Of course, you know, Silence of the Lambs and then Hannibal. It was all something. Well, I'm glad you're okay then, Douglas. But now tell me about the movie with Clooney. No wonder he's going to play you. You are an integral part of this thing.
Well, it's funny. I wrote this book, The Monster of Florence, and was published and was a, you know, very successful book. And then I got a call from my Hollywood agent, and he said, you know, George Clooney wants to purchase the book, purchase the movie rights. He wants to produce it. And he also wants to star in it. And I said, star in it? Oh, my God, I just can't imagine George Clooney as a serial killer. And my agent said, you moron, he's not going to play the serial killer, he's going to play you. I was totally floored.
Is going to happen, right?
Yeah, it's moving along. It'll be a few years before it's released. But
are you going to go to it?
I sure am. I don't know. I may have to go back to Italy for the filming, but I'm a little nervous about going back to Italy.
Yeah, they may arrest you again or something.
Well, fortunately, all the charges against me were dropped, and the prosecutor was disgraced for bringing those charges.
But this guy is still out there, the one you were just mentioning. I'm not so sure, Douglas, he stopped. This is just a guess on my part. But I'm just wondering if he's still doing it. He's just slowed down a little bit.
Well, you know, he was reprimanded and actually indicted for the Monster of Florence case. But
it seems like they're indicting anybody they want to.
Well, they do. And then, but when he, you know, prosecuted the Amanda Knox case, they restored all, they dropped the indictments, they papered it over. They did not want this prosecutor having a cloud over him while he prosecuted this girl. And it was basically a face-saving operation because, I mean, look, Amanda Knox was innocent. This whole thing was a railroad job from hell. And it continues today.
It's got to be a nightmare for her.
It was. Thank God, you know, the Italians engineered it so she left Italy, so at least they didn't have the embarrassment of keeping her in prison.
Right.
Longer, but
they're still going after her, though.
Well, they are. Yeah, it's all face saving. You know, they know perfectly well she's not going to go back to Italy.
We're not going to extradite her.
They're going to go through the motions. But you know, extraditing her would be a violation of her constitutional right of you know, double jeopardy,
mm-hmm.
Because the jury found her innocent in a full trial, and that's it.
So, would you ever go back and talk to this guy, the guy that we think is the serial killer?
No.
You want nothing to do with him.
No, it's interesting. Dateline NBC did a show on the Monster of Florence, the program.
Did they interview him?
They did. He wouldn't allow himself to be interviewed on camera or anything like that. But he did say to Stone Phillips, he said, one of the things that this FBI report said was that the monster was impotent. Well, our guy was really upset by that implication. He said, so these guys think I'm impotent? Well, you bring Mario Spezzi's wife down here, and you lay her on that table, and I'll show you how impotent I am.
Wow. Well, so he was almost admitting he was the one.
He was quite a piece of work, that guy.
That's strange. All right, Douglas, we're going to take some quick time out here for you and come back and take some phone calls as we talk about artificial intelligence and, I guess, serial killers, too.